It's Canucks Talk. I'm your host, Thomas Drance. Jamie Dodd, not with us today. We'll be back tomorrow. And we're going to be joined in this segment by our good friend, Ryan Clark, who doesn't have the usual buffer of Jamie to dissuade him from having to chat with me or to give him other options. Ryan, how are you and where do we find you? Are you in Edmonton?
Currently in Seattle, where I'm starting to wonder if Jamie isn't here, then why are we even having this segment or this show? Because everybody knows you listen to this show for Jamie, not you. We all know this.
Well, we're doing our best, man. We're playing hurt, okay? And we're happy to have you. Let's start with your big picture takeaways. The big picture takeaways on what you saw from Edmonton dispatching the Dallas Stars in six games.
There's one big question with the Oilers, which is, are they the most complete team in this postseason? And after what they did against the Dallas Stars, this is what makes it a fascinating question. For so many years, the Oilers had been this team. People kept saying, well, they score goals, but can they really prevent them? Can they stop them? Do they have the goaltending? Do they have the penalty kill? No one's really asking those questions anymore. What you saw last night was an example of this is what makes them a complete team. They're able to handle pressure. They're being outshot 3-1. You look at the shot share numbers in 5-on-5 play. The Stars own the puck nearly 74% of the time, and yet the Oilers handled it with seemingly no issues. The penalty kill was a perfect 3-for-3, and that's now a second straight series in which teams have failed to score against what's looking like one of the best all-time postseason penalty kills. Yes, McDavid gets the goal. Yes, you're seeing him and Draisaitl do what they do, but you're getting so many outside contributions from different players throughout their lineup, whether it be with goals, assists, or even sort of what we've seen from Darnell Nurse the last three games, where he goes under criticism 1 minute, and in the last three games, he's practically been flawless with the way he plays. You add how Stuart Skinner just fits within that system of just not really giving up goals. And when he does, it's maybe one or two. And it suddenly made the Oilers one of the more well-rounded teams that we've seen in recent postseason, like in the recent postseason. But again, it raises that question of, is this the most complete team in the postseason right now?
Well, and what do you think? I mean, their defensive game has leveled up to a point where I still don't think it's as good as Florida's, right? Like, as good as their penalty kill is, when Edmonton PP1 steps on the ice, it's going to be Barkov, Reinhardt, Ekblad, Forsling first over the boards. Like, I still think I want Florida 4-on-5 as good as the Edmonton penalty kill was against Dallas. I mean, in terms of completeness, I still think I have to give the edge to Florida, don't you?
See, I think this is where it gets really, really complicated, because for all these questions about what the Oilers aren't, they've shown that they can be these things. Yes, there might be personnel conversations you can have about which team is better, but when you look at how the personnel has meshed with the system, or how the system has meshed with the personnel, what you've seen from the Oilers has been the sort of results that's allowed them to not only get to the Cup final, but you think about the route that they've done it. So they play the LA Kings, where they go through some hiccups, but they close out that series in a smooth fashion. They essentially play nothing but one-goal games against the Vancouver Canucks in the second round. And then they go up against the Dallas Stars, a team that had beat the defending champs in round one, the team that won it 2 years ago in round two, and looked like it would be the anointed for this season for several reasons. And yet, this was supposed to be the deepest team in the West, and the Oilers found all sorts of answers to stop them. And so, while yes, Florida might have the personnel of a Barkov, who again is one of the best two-way forwards, arguably the best two-way forward in the league, there is something to be said for how the Oilers have found a way to make it work with their personnel, to make that system work, and not only get results, because again, when you look at who they've been playing the last two series, especially on the power play, they've had success against Quinn Hughes and JT Miller, and few people had success against JT Miller and Quinn Hughes in the regular season in the playoffs until the Oilers got there. The Stars' power play had all sorts of options with a two-time pretty goal scorer and Jason Robertson, someone with Wyatt Johnson's ability who is a 30-goal scorer that people look at and think, could he be the next star, not only after the Stars assembly line, but could he be one of the league's next great young stars? Miro Heiskanen, who at one point was looking like one of the heaviest favorites for the Conn Smythe this year, and they found an answer to suppress all of that. And that's with the likes of a Tyler Seguin and a Jamie Benn and Joe Pavelski, who his game is so ageless that it works in so many situations, and they stopped all of it. So there's something to be said for the path that the Oilers have gone through and what they've done, which, again, that's why it's fair to ask that question.
We're here with Ryan Clark, writer at ESPN.com, and one of our favorite guests and my noted frenemy. Ryan, pivoting off...
Oh, we're the friends. Quick sort of bullet... frenemies. We're friends. I just like giving you a hard time.
Oh, obviously. Sorry. We're friends in real life, but we're frenemies on the air. No. Nothing but love, of course, for Ryan Clark. So, local talking point today, Ryan, because there's a sense that the Stars maybe didn't show well in the conference final, and that lends itself quite naturally in a rabid Canadian market to the big question of what if, right? What if, how close were the Canucks? How close were the Canucks in your view? What's your take after the Western Conference final played out the way it did?
Maybe it's still the same as it was when the Western Conference final started, which was the Vancouver Canucks weren't that far away. Yes, you wonder what it looked like if they get to the conference final and have a healthy Thatcher Demko. Yes, Archer Shelov's had done quite a bit to get into this point, but also if you have a Vezina Trophy finalist and Thatcher Demko, that's certainly going to make a difference. But at the same time, it might not have made a difference. We just don't know. You certainly understand why the questions exist about the Canucks and what they could be, but it also goes back to something we've talked about on the show a lot the last few weeks, which is it's not so much about what could have been this season. It's so much about what could next year look like in the year after that, in the year after that, in the year after that, because with where the Canucks are right now, there's an opportunity for them to really cement themselves as one of those Western Conference elites that's in a perennial Stanley Cup conversation. They've got some off-season questions they need to answer, kind of like everyone else does at the moment. But while you understand why that conversation is being had in Vancouver throughout British Columbia, it's almost as if it's still the same answer as it was a few weeks ago, which is they're close. It's now just a matter of seeing, can they replicate this? Can they do what Dallas is doing right now, what Vegas is doing, what Colorado is doing, what Edmonton has done? It goes back to something Tyler Seguin said after the Game 6 last night, which was, you have to do a lot of losing to win in this league. He cited Tampa Bay. He cited Vegas. He even said, like, you look at the Florida Panthers. Like, the Florida Panthers went through some challenging seasons where they struggled to get out of the first round, and now they're in consecutive Stanley Cup finals for the first time in franchise history. And so being able to go through that is a telltale sign of, can you make this work long-term? And for the Canucks, it seems like that's the big question. Again, you did it this year. You surprised a lot of people. It's just, what can you do going forward? That's the major question.
So I want to give you a take, and then I'm going to ask you to annotate it, to bring your far superior insight to this take. Because my disagreement with you on the Canucks being right there or close, you know, and it's not a firm disagreement, just my qualifier would be, the Florida Panthers and the Edmonton Oilers generate shots better than everyone else in the league, 5-on-5. They generate quality looks better than everyone else. And when you don't do that, you can look like the Rangers did in the Eastern Conference Final, or like the Canucks did in Game 6 and 7 against the Oilers, or like the Stars did in the first four games, especially of the Conference Final, where it felt like they needed a lucky break. Like, it felt like you needed the opposition to make a mistake, or, you know, something against the grain, or a bounce, or a deflection. Like, it felt like you're out of answers. And it's so interesting how that offensive cliff comes for teams in the playoffs. Once you get to the pointy end and you're up against one of the five or six best teams, like the for me, the Canucks were going to hit that cliff against somebody, maybe Dallas, but they actually did hit it against Edmonton, so it's kind of an academic point. That's my take. What do you think?
Shot distribution and getting goals are important, but as we saw in Game 6, and maybe Game 6 is the outlier here, the Dallas Stars finished with more than 30 shots, had one goal. Yep. The Edmonton Oilers had what, 10 shots, 2 goals. Now, granted, we look at who the author of those goals are, and maybe that's the part where you just go, is that really apples to apples? Maybe it's more apples to rutabagas at this point. But still, it's that whole idea of, like, if the Canucks had gone far, yes, could they get the gold? And that's even a conversation right now when you look at what the Cup final is going to be, is when you look at who have been two of the best teams defensively that have been really adept at playing one-goal games, it has been the Florida Panthers and it has been the Edmonton Oilers. When you look at what they each do on the penalty kill, giving up goals is kind of what they do. So for all we know, we could see even more one-goal game finals. We could see another 3-2 final or 4-3 or 2-1 or what. Like, who's to say? But the point being is, like, yes, you need to be able to generate goals and get shots, and that's one of the big questions that face the Canucks. But also, who's to say that they maybe wouldn't have found openings against the Dallas Stars that they didn't find against the Edmonton Oilers? Because, again, and this is sort of the interesting part, isn't it, is whenever a team gets knocked out, there's always going to be those questions about, well, what went wrong? What could they have done? And sometimes it's less about, well, what did that team not do versus more of, well, the team they played, maybe they're just really good at what they do. And as we've talked about with the Oilers, they're in this conversation for a reason. And when you look specifically at shot prevention and goal prevention, especially in shorthanded situations, this is where they have excelled. And so, again, it's nothing against the Canucks, but is it more about the Canucks in this situation? Or is it more about this is the framework through which the Oilers have operated? It not only caused problems for the Kings, it caused problems for the Canucks, it caused problems for the Dallas Stars. There's a possibility it could cause problems for the Florida Panthers. And if it does, it's going to lead them to a championship. So, yeah, it's not, again, to say that goal prevention, that creating goals and getting shots isn't an issue for the Canucks, because it was at times, but it's also to say, well, they were going up against a five-player structure that honestly might end up being one of, if not the best in the league, which is why they might win the Stanley Cup.
So are you leaning toward picking against Canada's team in the Stanley Cup final? And I want to be clear here, Canada's team is the Florida Panthers.
At this point, the pick would probably be the Oilers.
Wow.
It probably would be just because both have been adept at winning one goal games, but this is just what it comes back to. The Oilers have been in situations like they were against the Canucks and like they were against the Stars in which they could have lost those series. There were moments in the second round when it looked like Vancouver was going to win that series, but Edmonton, whether it was through what they did on ice or decisions made by Chris Knobloch and his staff, they won games. It was the same thing in the Dallas series. They were down 2-1 at one stage, and there was a thought after game 3 of maybe this is another year where they just get to the conference final and that's just it. But again, it's the adjustments that they make with the personnel. It's the adjustments that they make in-game that just with each passing contest, it leads you to wonder, is this the year for the Oilers? And when you look at the contributions they get, again, the narrative that this is just a two-player team, it's old, it's done, it's beyond that. They have a legitimate top first pairing. They're getting a consistency out of Darnell Nurse the last 3 games, which is something that you expect for a player of his caliber. Stuart Skinner is doing everything to not only help them win games, but he's someone who both works within what they do, but also he's showing that he can make the necessary saves that maybe don't go according to plan in terms of what they want to allow. For all the guys that we've talked about on that team, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, outside of McDavid and Draisaitl, might be in the discussion for their most viable forward because of everything he can do in the all-around play. And keep in mind, they've been able to get goals and do all this while someone like Evander Kane, who is a 9-time 20-goal scorer, has been moved to a third-line role. It's a lot of options for this team. And it's not to say that, hey, look, the Florida Panthers may not have answers, because we've seen the Florida Panthers not only have answers, but they're a team that learned a lot from what they went through last year in the Cup Final. And it seems like the biggest difference between them now versus a year ago is it seems like they might be a lot healthier. Last year, the injuries, it took a toll. This year, it seems like they might be in better shape. But even with all that, it's hard to really discount the Oilers at this stage.
What do you think Connor McDavid's goal last night and his dominance throughout this playoffs means for hockey in the U.S.? Like, Edmonton, Florida doesn't exactly sound like a sexy marquee for the Stanley Cup Final from a U.S. broadcast ratings perspective, but has McDavid hit a level where he can translate?
Potentially, because the thing is, you're about to see the player who's been considered to be the game's best on the biggest stage where he is the only show in town. It's just, it's a matter of what's the realistic expectation, because if he's scoring goals like the one he did in game six in every game, then it's going to attract a lot of attention. But even if he doesn't, it's still going to attract attention because there's this interest of, can he win it? Especially when we're getting into this era, and you could say that we've already been there, but we're at that stage where Sidney Crosby and Alexander Ovechkin, it looks like they're about to enter the winner of their careers, at least fall, but in the winner of their careers. And as this league is shifting towards, well, who are those next faces? We've seen Nathan MacKinnon, Cale Makar, Jack Eichel win. We're now trying to see, is it going to be Barkov and Tkachuk? Is it going to be McDavid and Draisaitl? And then it's that question of, well, then who's going to be next after them? Like, will it be Matthews and Marner at some point? Will it be someone else? Will it be Connor Bedard? Will it be Macklin Celebrini within the next eight? Like, no one knows, but the point is this. For all the conversations that are being had about how do you sort of advance the league and how do you push it forward, these sort of moments help. So yeah, while Edmonton, Florida for some might not necessarily be the most sexy matchup, the point is this, you're talking about two teams that look personality-wise, one of them has a personality in Matthew Tkachuk, who you know this from your time in South Florida. Before it's all said and done, Matthew Tkachuk ended up being one of the biggest personalities South Florida has ever seen from a sports standpoint. And when it comes to Edmonton, for all the Hall of Famers and great players they've had come through, McDavid is another one of those guys who checks those boxes, who's going to hit 1,000 points before he turns 30, which to say that out loud is just wild. And so, yeah, if he can get more of those goals, sure, but also if he can win, that might be enough.
Well, I can't wait to order some steak with you one day at Matthew Tkachuk's inevitable Fort Lauderdale Steakhouse, right on Las Olas, I'm sure, with a sick patio with which to, on which to eat outside. Ryan, thank you so much. This is Ryan Clark from ESPN, one of our absolute favorites. Thanks for joining us today, sir.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me. Take care.
We'll be back. We've got an open segment on the other side. Use the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line to get into it with me, your host, Thomas Drance. You are listening to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. It's the final segment today of Canucks Talk. I'm your host, Thomas Drance. Jamie Dodd, my usual co-host, will be back on the program tomorrow. Canucks Talk, of course, is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com. Of course, this show is always coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? And this segment, we're going to do some question and response. It'll be an open segment, so please liberally use the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line, and we may get to your questions, your queries, your pressing questions about the Vancouver Canucks and the 2024 Stanley Cup Final. Dunbar Lumber, of course, has three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver. Visit them online at dunbarlumber.com. All right, we have some questions coming in from the first segment that we're going to start us off. Please text in 650-650. That's the Dunbar Lumber text line. Unsigned. Hey, Drance, who are some budget FAs that the Canucks should be interested in? And this is a two-parter. It continues, and do you think Ratu, Podkolzin, or Sasson can make the jump during the next season? I don't see it from the start. So let's start with the second part. Atu Ratu had a really strong end to his 2023-24 campaign down in Abbotsford. Hopefully he's beginning to get some traction. He'll need a big summer. Most of his success later in the year came on the wing. So this was always the concern after the Bo Horvat trade, was there was some skepticism within industry circles among talent evaluators about whether or not Ratu had sufficient speed to hold up long-term as a center, or whether he may ultimately have to move to the wing full-time. Look, it's still an open question. He's still young enough that, you know, we don't know, but his most success last year came on the wing. I'll be curious to see how the Canucks handle that at training camp next year. You know, this organization's tended to try and let guys fail at center before moving them to wing, especially with a young player like Ratu. But if they're going to put him in sort of the best position to come out of camp with a job, I do think trialing him on the wing, you know, as sort of a potential third or fourth line competitor, you know, that to me makes the most sense. Podkolzin, I think, has to be on this team to begin the season next year. We'll see how things shape up with Dakota Joshua, but you could see it when Podkolzin was inserted into the lineup after Joshua got hurt in that Chicago game. Man, they needed his size. If Joshua's not re-signed, if Joshua hits the open market, and there's going to be a lot of interest in his services if he does, if he departs, I really struggle to imagine that Vancouver's not going to need what Podkolzin can bring, simply with the big body and the ability to play physical, take the puck to the net, play in straight lines, that he can bring even if the offense never comes, right? Even if the offense never develops at the rate you'd certainly hope for a player who was selected with a top 10 pick just 5 years ago. And then we get to Max Sasson. Now, Sasson's an interesting one. To me, he would seem like the guy who probably needs the most time. Another year, I struggle to imagine, just given the draft capital and everything, that you know, he'd be sort of on the short list to break camp with the team. But I actually wonder if he might be the most likely to make an impact over the course of the season, just given the overall two-way profile of his game, the speed, and the fact that he's a true center, unquestioned, right? At some point, if this team needs a depth centerman, if this team needs some injury reinforcements, if they need a sheltered third line winger to log, you know, somewhere between 9 and 12 minutes in a given game or for a week of games, I think Sasson's put himself in a position to be maybe the first guy up out of training camp. But I also feel like entering training camp, he'll have the longest climb, just given the investment, just given the draft capital that Ratu and Podkolzin kind of have behind them. I'd suspect those guys get longer runway at the start, but Sasson might be the most likely to play a role for this team when injuries strike over the course of the season. As for the value free agents, you know, it's tough. Like, it's going to be a very tough market. One guy that stands out to me as a value prop worth considering is Kiefer Sherwood. We saw him play really well on that highly impactful Nashville Predators fourth line in their first round series against the Vancouver Canucks. I liked the speed. I liked the grit. I thought he was really good in that series. He'd be a guy I'd look at as, you know, like a Sam Lafferty type replacement, a guy who can bring some of that and maybe even play with a more consistent identity for you next season. I'd look at a guy like Michael Amadio, 27 points this past year, has regularly logged top nine shifts for Vegas during some of their deepest playoff runs. I think he's been really good for them. And you know, just another winger to sort of give you some, like, give you some breadth in terms of being a guy who can move up the lineup and support skilled players, which I think this team's going to need more of. I mean, we saw it when the Besser injury happened, and all of a sudden you've got like Mikheyev on the top line, and like you've got some guys who you really just don't trust to finish. And I think Amadio maybe gives you a little bit more offense than that in sort of a similar role or a similar look. You know, Jordan Martinook's a guy out of Carolina who's mostly played wing in Carolina, but I think still has some center in his game, like could still potentially contribute as a center for the Canucks in a world where Bluger and Lindholm depart. Could he be a down market consideration? Danton Heinen is a guy whose name jumps off the board, you know, just given his connections, you know, to some in the Canucks organization and his local ties. Jalen Chatfield is a popular name out there, obviously has come into his own in Carolina the past couple of years, was a longtime Canucks prospect, still has some significant fans in significant roles within the organization. Brendan Dillon, another local kid, might be open to coming here. Christian Fisher is another big winger from Detroit. Connections between him and Rick Tocchet, for whom he played in Arizona. He's another one who's like a big body. Could he add to your options in a world where you lose Dakota Joshua? To me, that would be like a good down market consideration. And then like my number one target among value UFAs this year, like the guy, my this year's Appleton is going to be Nick Blankenberg, group six, unrestricted free agent out of Columbus. Didn't play enough NHL games for them to maintain his RFA rights. He's 25, relatively recent college grad. I think he's only in his third pro season. Right-handed, can play left or right, a little bit undersized, but super physical, super feisty, high-end competitor, good wheels, high enough skill level to contribute to the build-up, even if he's not like a point producer or an offensive threat from the blue line in. Nick Blankenberg is at the very top of my list. Tim, by the way, asks, why is Sam Reinhart not being talked about all that much compared to Guentzel when talking about an off-season signing? This is his hometown team. And I think the reason is that for a lot of people, the idea that Reinhart inevitably gets done in Florida is just kind of taken for granted. Just taken for granted. So that would be my answer to that. You know, it's just assumed that Reinhart's not making it anywhere close to July 1st, even though we're at June 3rd. There's still hockey to be played. Everyone assumes that that'll get done within the industry. Troy, by the way, asks me to clarify, are you saying Sam Lafferty is out? I'm not. I think there's fans of his game, you know, off of Griffith's Way at Rogers Arena. I'm not saying he's out. I'm just looking at guys who could, you know, one-to-one fill a replacement from some of these UFAs and maybe do it at a cheaper ticket. That's it. So, you know, I'm saying if Lindholm leaves, if Bluger leaves, if Joshua leaves, by no means are any of those fait accompli. But I do think you have to begin to think about, you know, if Zadorov isn't, you know, if the club can't afford to retain Zadorov, does Brendan Dillon help you offset that at a lower price point, right? Like, I do think this club's going to have to think about that in preserving their defensive solidity while still sort of upping their game in terms of finding another level to their ability to attack offensively. We've got a question about Nick Bjugstad. I like this one. Considering we're likely losing Lindholm, Drancer, how do you feel about Nick Bjugstad, right-handed centerman, plus size, decent in the circle? Does he kill penalties? You know, this is a guy who's really redesigned his game later in his career to be more like a workman-like fourth-line center. He is, however, still under contract, $2.1 million with the Utah franchise, the as-yet-unnamed Utah franchise. Hopefully they're called the Utah Wagon. I don't think they will be. They're going to be like the Utah Yeti or something, but you know, I like Bjugstad a lot as a third line center. I don't like him a lot necessarily as a penalty killing specialist. I don't think you're looking at a 1-for-1 replacement on Bluger, but you might be looking at a guy who could be like who could give you more offensively than Teddy Bluger. As much as Bjugstad has redesigned his game, this is still a guy with I think, like a really good shot, really good offensive instincts. I think there's maybe a little bit more, a touch more offensively with Bjugstad than you get from Bluger, but I don't think you're quite getting like first over the boards PK specialist, you know, defensive. That you're getting a good defensive center. You're not getting Teddy Bluger, who in my opinion is a higher end defensive center. For me, the sort of one for ones, the affordable one for ones for Bluger are guys like Travis Boyd, and you know, like a Mark Edward Belmar. There's not a ton of options, to be totally honest with you. It doesn't feel like a very robust market for third line centermen. I'm asked if I went to the Firebirds game Friday from a listener who clearly knows I'm down in the desert. I didn't. I'm hoping for a game six so that I can go. But yes, it would be a ton of fun. Here's an interesting one. A trade speculation question. Unsigned texter asks, what do you think of trading Podkolzin and a second for Kako Capo, the New York Rangers, or Capo Kako, the New York Rangers winger, or Hoglander in a third? And how much is Kako's contract going to be? So this one's interesting to me in part because I do love the idea, just as a general rule, of trying to get these elite draft capital guys before they break out. And in Kako's case, you know, 19 points in 61 games, like he has not delivered on the promise of being selected second overall, especially offensively. Played 15 games for the Rangers in the playoffs, just 2 points. To me, there's some limitations with Kako given his lack of foot speed and his lack of development in terms of his skating stride. He's 23 now, so I think you're getting to sort of the outside envelope of where maybe it's not reasonable to expect him to just level up as a skater at this stage of his career. But I still like him a lot below the hash marks. And at the age of 23, given, you know, his deployment, I still think there's a possibility that you could end up mining a guy who's got a little bit more offensive punch than he's shown to this point in his career. Like at the very least, I think you could look at him as a guy capable of giving you some of, but not necessarily the same level of meanness and snarl of what this team was able to get from Dakota Joshua, right? Sort of the ability to get in on the forecheck, the ability to you know, finish around the net front, to be defensively reliable on a third line role. You know, I don't know that you're getting the penalty killer. I don't think he's as fast a skater, but if you're looking for that sort of replacement, I think that makes sense. Would you be willing to pay a second round pick premium in addition to Podkolzin, who's kind of a similar bet player at a similar age? Although Kako's been better, frankly, for his NHL career. You know, I'd think about that one. I think third and Hoglander is one that I'd struggle with, just given that Hoglander has produced relatively consistently, like in a top nine or even top six role. He's just been more productive, especially 5-on-5 from a rate stat perspective, and you know, is still young enough that I'm more interested in Hoglander's long-term upside than I am in Kako's. So, you know, I like Kako. I like that type of thinking. There's a lot of like distressed younger players who were premium assets a few years ago, and maybe the shine's come off. I like the idea of buying a couple of those types. You know, I think you look no further than the Florida Panthers. I think they've had a ton of success with buying Reinhardt and Sam Bennett and guys like that at a moment where they were no longer viewed as top prospects, but weren't quite at the point of being seen the way they are today as like established difference makers on a contender. So, you know, I like that approach. Trevor Zegras is another name that looms large in my imagination on this score. So, you know, that's not like, I don't think that's a bad idea. I just think certainly the Hoglander in a third one to me, goes a little bit too far. Here's another unsigned text that interests me. Drancer, it seems Vancouver's front office has gone with the almost hyperactive approach we've seen from Vegas, Florida, and even Carolina. What lessons do you think they can take from these teams this summer to level up? So this one to me is interesting because I actually think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding in comparing the way that the Canucks have churned their roster with how Florida and Vegas in particular have done it. Carolina probably as well. We'll deal with them too. So with Vegas, I think the fundamental insight that Vegas has brought to how they operate, right, is they've sold good players in the offseason. So in the offseason, teams have more cap space and more liquidity and more flexibility to consider taking on salary, to consider taking on big contracts. So it's in the summer when they'll rearrange the decks and deal, you know, a Max Pacioretty or a Nate Schmidt, right? Like they'll use the off seasons when teams have cap flexibility to trade salary. And it's in season, especially when they're in LTI, that they buy salaried players, right? And they buy them for the long term. Noah Hanifin and Tomáš Hertl are obviously the most recent example, but like Jack Eichel was bought in season. So it's like they wait until no one else can take these contracts or very few other contending teams who have an interest in bolstering their lineup short term can take these players. And then that's when Vegas likes to buy. And then they try to sell players. They try to sell contracts in the offseason. And I think that's smart because it gets them on this cycle where they're always buying what's relatively cheap, what like is for sale. They're always paying sale prices because they're on the opposite cycle of everyone else. Like everyone else wants to add, everyone else is too capped out usually to buy salary in the season, right? But they want players, but it has to be money in, money out. Vegas will be like, oh, we'll figure out a way to take Tomáš Hertl. Sure, we'll figure it out. That's the big difference. And then obviously in the offseason, everyone wants players and has cap space. And that's when Vegas pounces on that. So I think that's the key thing with Vegas that's different from Vancouver. Vancouver's decidedly not playing in that same cyclical market with the same level of discipline, at least based on what we've seen so far. With Florida, what you're seeing, I think, is, you know, Florida's a really fascinating one because I think you're seeing a wave of them buying on upside. And you're seeing them do it on a multitude of different levels, right? So you're seeing it in terms of, you know, Huberto and Uyghur out the door for Tkachuk. That's a trade that made them younger. At first blush, everyone thought it was a trade, honestly, that probably made them worse short term, but extended their window. Instead, Tkachuk was at such a high level and Huberto fell off so dramatically so quickly that it made Florida better right away. But that wasn't necessarily even in the design of the trade. Nonetheless, Tkachuk, rare piece, one for one power forward, like we'll fire all weapons to get him and we'll avoid the long-term commitments, you know, to some players that we've decided are peripheral to the core. You've seen them gamble on Bennett and Reinhardt in similar fashion, right? Back in the summer of or the fall of 2020, you saw them place a huge amount of bets. Alexander Wenberg, after he was bought out, you saw them sign Colin White the next year after he was bought out. Verhaeghe, obviously, on a two-year deal. Anthony Duclair on a two-year deal, like a huge volume of bets placed. And then they were relatively ruthless about being like, okay, you know, Verhaeghe's at the point of being a core guy, we'll extend him, right? Wenberg is not, we'll let him walk in free agency. Duclair is not, we're actually going to trade him. And they've sort of went through this process pretty ruthlessly. By the way, it's not like every swing they took connected. There were lots of like Vinny Hinostrozas thrown in there too, guys who didn't work that they'd quickly move on from. So nonetheless, though, you're seeing them gamble on big ticket items in your Reinhardt, Bennett, Tkachuk tier. You're seeing them gamble on mid-tier guys in unrestricted free agency, really prioritizing upside and doing it at high volume. And you're seeing them do it even on the waiver wire with defensemen, you know, even to the point of claiming Noah Juulsen, right? Then trading him to Vancouver to get a look at Olli Juolevi, right? Ultimately, they trade a useful NHL player in Juulsen for a guy who's not that useful in Juolevi, but the point wasn't that they wanted the seventh defenseman in the deal. They wanted a look at Juolevi. Maybe there's a chance here. He was a fifth overall pick. Maybe there's something that we can get out of this guy. Just a high volume of bets. And so for every Gustav Forsling, there's a Juulsen or a Kevin Connaughton or, you know, a Olli Juolevi that didn't work out, but they just keep swinging and they just keep swinging on upside. And then they've done really well actually connecting on that upside. But again, you know, you're seeing a relatively high volume of moves. I don't think you're seeing nearly as many in season. And I think you're seeing a sort of more measured approach to like really prioritizing upside in a way that I don't think you would say the Canucks have done. Like, I think what the Canucks have done that's distinct from Florida, especially over, like, if we just isolate it to the last, you know, 16 months, what we really saw the Canucks do was subtract Horvat for assets, use those assets to buy a right-handed defenseman, right? And then slowly go about reallocating, like, the Oliver Ekman-Larsson cap space and just taking care of every possible part of their roster that could have mangled them this season, right? It was like, we don't need to make sure that we have the best second and third pair, but we need a second and third pair that doesn't give it all back. And so Ian Cole, three. Carson Soucy, 3.5 times 3. Ultimately, they trade for Zadorov. You know, that we saw the Hronik deal. They built like a blue line that addressed their floor. There was a high level of NHL competence on the Canucks' back end. The Canucks weren't necessarily making upside swings for potential stars. You saw it likewise up front. Bluger, Lindholm ultimately comes in to replace Bo Horvat, and even Lindholm, a higher end player. You know, we're talking about a guy who brought a right-handed draw, could kill penalties, bolstered their center depth. Like, even that's a floor bet. So the Canucks have churned through and I think attained a competitive advantage because of how quickly they're able to admit their own mistakes, frankly, and just, like, change the decks. But I think there's a real ruthlessness on Vancouver's end in just, like, addressing the hockey shortcomings of the roster with sharp, affordable floor bets. That's almost the direct opposite of how the Florida Panthers have done it. Because the Panthers are chasing upside and kind of figuring out fit later, whereas Vancouver's chasing fit and floor in so many of the moves that we've seen over a very impressive sequence of team building from Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin over the next 18 months. All right, we're going to close Canucks Talk for today. We'll be back tomorrow with Jamie Dodd. Just to remind you before we go that Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. You can find them together online at dleamc.com. We were coming to you live from the Kintec studio, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? And a big shout out to all of you at home helping us get through, especially this last segment, with all of your interesting texts and questions. I'm sorry we couldn't get to them all. I'll bookmark the most interesting ones after the show and bring them up to discuss later over the course of the week. That's the magic of contributing to our show with the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. All right, that's going to do it for me, your host, flying solo today. And thank you for sticking with me. You've been listening to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.